So this is the third week that I'm talking about the path of practice through the Buddha's own words. And this week, the title of my talk comes from the sutta that I'm going to talk about. And the title of it is Only the Seen. And that'll become more clear as I talk about this sutta. But first I'd like to kind of summarize what I talked about in the last couple of times. The first week I talked about a sutta where the Buddha gave instructions to a group of people who were confused about how to know what was true. And his basic instructions were, when you see that something is wholesome and non-harming and does not cause suffering, then you should engage in it and practice it. When you see that something is unwholesome, unskillful, and causes harm and suffering to yourself or others, then you should refrain from it. But it comes back basically to doing the practice yourself, to not count on or rely on sources of truth coming from texts, from teachers, from culture, but to bring whatever we learn into our experience and test it there based on this, looking at whether something is wholesome and leads us away from suffering or unwholesome and leads us towards suffering. So it comes back to this idea of come and see for yourself. Put the teachings into practice and see what result they have in your life. Run the experiment on your life, essentially. I find this to be an incredibly powerful teaching and one that I come back to over and over again. Anytime I have confusion or doubt, particularly around the practice, I come back to this idea of, well, just look into my experience and see, really connect. Connect with what's happening rather than spinning and thinking about what's going on. Connect with what's going on. Come and see. And then last week, I talked a little bit about some of the Buddha's teachings on suffering and the end of suffering. In particular, I talked about the teaching on dependent origination, which describes in a very detailed process, a cause and effect chain, essentially, of how we get from our everyday experience into suffering. That basically, you know, we start with the contact of our experience with the world and what happens to us after that point. We contact that experience, there's some pleasant or unpleasant sensation that results from that contact, and typically what happens is that we spring off of that pleasantness or unpleasantness and start wanting to grasp onto the things that are pleasant and wanting to push away the things that are unpleasant. And from there, we cycle out and spin out into reactivity and generally into suffering from that simple movement away from pleasant or unpleasant. So we can see how in our own experience, again, this comes in our own experience that we witness this, the truth of this teaching, basically. What I talked about last week, I think I said, you know, don't just take it from the teaching. Look in your own experience. Is it true? Look and see what happens when you contact something pleasant. Do you reach out to it and start to want it and hold it, identify with it? When something unpleasant happens, do you push it away? What happens in your experience around this? Tonight, I'd like to talk about some of the teachings the Buddha gave around how to actually practice. I'll talk about one teaching in particular the Buddha gave about how to practice. How to practice this path so that we can see how we create suffering, how we can free ourselves from suffering. How do we actually engage in this practice? The Buddha gave a lot of different meditation instructions. In one sutta, the Satipatthana Sutta, called the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, that's the typical translation given for this sutta, he gave 21 different techniques or practices for practicing meditation. The sutta is broken into four foundations: the body, the feeling tone, which I talked about some last week, this notion of whether it's pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, mind states, and objects of mind. And in the body, he gave 14 different instructions on working with the body. I think this gives some kind of indication of the emphasis the Buddha put on practicing with body. He gave practices about the breath meditation. That's kind of the one that we center on in this center that we primarily teach. But he also talked about practices for daily life, noticing when you're coming and going, when you're reaching and bending your arms, when you're going to the bathroom, when you're walking, when you're eating, when you're talking, when you're silent. He gave instructions about pay attention in all of these times. He gave instructions about paying attention to bodily posture, just the simple, am I sitting? Am I standing? Am I walking? Am I lying down? Very, very simple instruction. If you just paid attention to that and were aware at all times that of your bodily posture, you would experience a lot of the depth of the teaching of the Dharma. Joseph Goldstein had a teacher, Munindra, who often said, if you sit and know that you're sitting, the entire of the Dharma will be revealed to you. So the Buddha also gave instructions on how to practice with the feeling tone of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. He gave instructions about how to practice with states of mind, whether the mind is calm or agitated, whether it's tired or alert. And the Buddha gave instructions about how to practice with various ways to look at who we are as a human being, breaking our body down into the six sense bases, seeing, smelling, hearing, tasting, touching, and the mind. So the Buddha gave a lot of different instructions about practicing mindfulness. He also gave instructions on practicing concentration, how to practice concentration. Concentration was not something new that the Buddha discovered or created. The concentration practices were well known in India at the time of the Buddha. And in fact, he practiced them before he discovered his own understanding of the truth. And there are like 42 different subjects of concentration that are enumerated in the commentaries that you can pay attention to. You can pay attention to different, you know, visualizations of color or earth or fire or you can pay attention to loving kindness. So there's all kinds of different ways to concentrate the mind. And part of the reason why I'm saying this, how many different kinds of meditation practices there are, is that there isn't really one particular technique. I think that part of the reason he taught so many different techniques is because there's not necessarily one particular technique that works for everybody. So he taught a range of practices. And I'm going to pick one of the many practices that he talked about and go into it in a little bit of detail and explore it and explore how I've worked with it in my own practice. But if it doesn't resonate with you, if it doesn't connect with you, don't worry about it. You know, it simply may be that you're in tune with a different kind of teaching, a different practice. So there's many, many different kinds of practices. The Buddha also gave some very succinct instructions that are great. There's one-liner that's just a wonderful instruction that Joseph Goldstein often likes to quote the Buddha saying, "Nothing is to be clung to as me or mine." And when Joseph talked about this, he said, when I first read this, I looked at it as a statement of kind of fact. You know, that's the way the Buddha thought it should be. He said, but then I realized it's actually an instruction. It's a way we're supposed to operate in our lives, to constantly look, am I clinging to something? Am I holding on to something? Can I let go of something that I'm holding on to? Explore this idea of me and mine. What is mine? How does that notion come to be? What am I? All of that is kind of packed into this very simple one line. Nothing is to be clung to as me or mine. And there's one other very famous, very short, succinct teaching, and that's the one I'm going to talk about tonight. And it's described in a sutta called the Bahiya Sutta. Basically, it's called the Bahiya Sutta because it's instructions to a monk named Bahiya. And I'll give a little bit of the context of this sutta. I'll summarize it for you before I read the actual instruction that the Buddha gave. So Bahiya was not practicing in the Buddha's. He was not a disciple of the Buddha. He lived very far away from where the Buddha lived. He lived on the ocean. He lived on the coast. And in fact, it's said that he was in a boat wreck with people, and everyone else in the boat wreck was killed, and he washed up on the shore with a plank that he was carrying, you know, that he was floating on, in this town along the coast of India. And he used that plank as his cloth. He basically tied it to him as his way to cover himself up. And so he was called Bahiya of the bark cloth. And he practiced very diligently and was very respected in the area where he was practicing. He got a lot of offers of clothes, and he turned those down. He stayed with his plank and food, and he got all the requisites that he needed. And he probably practiced some of these forms of concentration that I mentioned earlier, because that was generally the teaching that was available in the time of the Buddha. And at one point, after practicing for some time, he had this thought. This thought occurred to him: I wonder if I'm enlightened. And the story goes that a heavenly being who in an earlier life had been a relative of his saw that he was thinking this thought and knew that he was wrong, and came down to visit him and appeared in front of him and said, no, no, you're not enlightened. You're not even on the path to enlightenment. And so he said, well, I guess you're right. You know, kind of woke him up. It's like kind of startling. It's like, yeah, I guess you're right. I'm not enlightened. But is there anyone who is? Is there anyone who can show me the path? And this heavenly being said, yes, there is, actually. There is a monk who lives up in northern India. And I believe he was in Savatthi at the time. And he knows the path. And having heard that, Bahiya was so inspired that he left immediately to travel to where the Buddha lived. And it says that it was about 720 miles of a journey. He, you know, walked it all on foot. And the story, well, there's confusing or conflicting translations of the story. Some of the stories say he did it in one night. He got 720 miles in one night by the help of this heavenly being that was with him. Another story says, well, that's a nice, you know, idea, but probably what this meant in this translation is that he didn't stop for more than one night anywhere along the way. That he basically didn't rest in his journey. He would walk all day and stop and sleep at night and then walk all day the next day. So imagine how long this would take, you know, 720 miles, 20, 30 miles a day at most. It's going to take you 30 days, 40 days to do this journey if you can keep going, keep traveling. And so he did this. Imagine Imagine 30, 40 days on foot to just go ask a question of somebody. I think that's pretty inspiring. So he traveled all this way, and when he arrived where the Buddha was staying, he found all of the monks that were practicing with the Buddha. He saw them practicing walking meditation. And he went up to one of them and said, "Where can I meet this teacher that I've heard about?" And one of them said, "Well, he's gone to town for the alms round." So he followed off after, hoping to find the Buddha on his alms round. And he did. He saw the Buddha walking. And the story goes that he saw how beautiful in bearing the Buddha was. And he was immediately inspired by the Buddha's bearing and knew, this is a person I can learn something from. And he went to the Buddha and he said, "Please teach me what you have to teach." And the Buddha said, basically, you know, here he is, he's on alms round, and he has a practice of not only eating once a day and not afternoon. And so he's got a limited amount of time to gather his food and eat his meal. So he says, "Now's not the time, Bahia. I'm in the midst of going on alms rounds." But Bahia persists. And he said, "We don't know how long you're going to live or how long I'm going to live. Please teach me the Dharma." And again, the Buddha said, "Not now." But Bahia persisted, and in the Buddhist stories, the third time is usually the charm. There's only a few instances in the Pali Canon where the Buddha refused something after the third time. And so this time he stopped, and standing by on the way to his alms round, he gave Bahia a teaching. And I'll read to you what that teaching was. Now, when Bahia heard this teaching, after Bahia heard this teaching, he instantly became completely enlightened. So this can be a very powerful teaching. So he said, "Here in Bahia, you should train yourself thus. In the seen will be merely what is seen. In the heard will be merely what is heard. In the sensed will be merely what is sensed. In the cognized will be merely what is cognized. In this way, you should train yourself, Bahia. When, Bahia, for you, in the seen is merely the seen, in the heard is merely the heard, in the sensed merely the sensed, the cognized merely the cognized, then, Bahia, you will not be with that. When, Bahia, you are not with that, then you will not be in that. When you are not in that, then, Bahia, you will be neither here nor beyond nor in between the two. Just this is the end of suffering." So that's a fairly short teaching. So what does it mean? What is the Buddha saying to Bahia? First, I'd just like to go back over the point that Bahia became fully enlightened after hearing this. So I think partly what this points to, the fact that he became fully enlightened when hearing this, is that he had done a great deal of practice already. His practice was pretty deep. It seems like, you know, he had probably been doing quite a bit of practice of concentration, of renunciation in the town on the coast. And what he basically needed was to hear a teaching that kind of turned his perspective on his experience. And I can imagine him basically, while the Buddha was speaking, experiencing exactly what he was saying, that in the seen is only the seen, that everything that he saw, that's all there was the seeing. There weren't any thoughts or any ideas that came off out of it. In the heard is only the heard, simply the sounds coming and going. So I can imagine that he was kind of practicing right then and there with what the Buddha said. And then going beyond that, moving on to the pointers of letting go of self, letting go of identification, that those pointers could have allowed him to subsequently let go of the clinging. So there was a very strong depth of practice of Bahia in the first place. And then there's this, it was said that the Buddha was brilliant at knowing exactly what somebody needed to hear in a moment. That was part of his brilliancy of teaching, that he could kind of see where somebody was and give them exactly the right instruction for the moment. So I think that the fact that Buddha became completely enlightened and the fact that we don't become completely enlightened when we hear that doesn't mean that we should dismiss this teaching as something that's not for us, but to rather explore it. What does it mean? What is the Buddha actually saying here? So the first part of the sutta, basically, you know, it's broken into two parts. And the first part says, you should train yourself like this. Train yourself so that in the seen is only the seen, in the heard is only the heard, the sensed is only the sensed, in the cognized is only the cognized. This is essentially in what we would call, in our kind of modern language, we would call it bare attention. You may have heard that term, bare attention, where we basically connect with our bare experience without proliferating off of our experience into thoughts and ideas about the experience. And there's also a component of it, to it, of non-reactivity to what we experience. If in the seen is just the seen, there's no reactivity to what is seen. It's simply seen. It's simply experienced. Carol Wilson, one of my teachers at the Insight Meditation Society, gave an instruction about this on a retreat once that kind of just really hit me. She was talking about how we can know we've gotten lost. She said, you know, if you're watching somebody doing walking meditation and you're thinking about how much better than you they are, then you forgot to note seeing. You know, you did not notice that you saw that person, because if you'd noticed you'd seen the person, you would have seen that inclination to jump off of that thought. But you didn't even see that. So if you can see at times that you're lost in thought like that, you forgot to notice some bare experience, whether it was a sight, a sound, a bodily sensation, or something in the mind. Sometimes we can trigger off of things arising in the mind, a bare experience of thought. The mind produces thoughts, kind of like the eye receives sights. You know, that's part of the function of the mind, to produce thoughts. The other part of the function of the mind is to experience thoughts. But there's this way in which the mind and thoughts are not that much different than any of our other sense doors. And we respond and react to things that come up in our mind just like we respond and react to things that come up in our sense experience. So this teaching points us to kind of realize, you know, that much of what we experience as seeing or think we experience as seeing is really constructed in our mind. You know, if we see somebody that we have some difficulty with, You know, as soon as we see that person, all of that difficulty arises, and we think we're seeing that person just as they are, but really what we're seeing them is through this filter of all the thoughts and ideas we have about them. So can we just experience? Can we just experience the person without all of those thoughts? It's very challenging to do this. But the first step really is to just notice all the reactivity and notice, oh, did I actually notice that I saw this person before I jumped into all the reactivity? This goes for all of our experience, sights, sounds, smells, tastes, touches. Typically what happens is what is very similar to what I described in the talk I gave last week. We experience a sight, and you know, there's the contact of the sight, which brings the consciousness of seeing. And very shortly after that, there's an experience of pleasant or unpleasant, usually. And from there, we spring off of it into wanting or not wanting it. But there's another piece of this experience also that is not really highlighted in the chain of dependent origination that I gave. And that's the perception. So in that contact of experience where we see a sight and there's the consciousness of seeing, seeing happens. In that moment, there's the pleasant, unpleasant aspect of the experience that I talked about last week. But there's also the perception of the thing, of what we're seeing. It's the perception of color, of form. It's the perception of male or female. It's the perception of person. It's many, many different layers of perceptions built on top of each other. And at some point in that building up of perception, we leap into beliefs and ideas. It's almost seamless for us that we go from seeing the shape and the form to identifying a female, to identifying a person, to identifying this person, to identifying what this person did to me. It's just one after the other. But the perception of what you're seeing, that's essentially what this teaching is pointing us to. Can we just be with the perceptions and not spring into ideas and thoughts about it? Now, this movement to move from perception into thought is pretty deeply ingrained in us. It's not going to go away just because we think it might be a good idea to stop it. I really saw this pretty clearly at one point when I passed out. I was a little dehydrated. I was in the Peace Corps and I was on a remote island and I was somewhat dehydrated and I was in a latrine and I was not feeling very good and I realized I wasn't feeling very good and I kind of hung on to the wall, but that didn't help because I just passed out and I landed on my head in this latrine. I was lucky it wasn't one of those that was just an open pit. But I landed on my head, and I think that brought the blood to my head. I don't think I was out for very long. But when I opened my eyes landed on the bamboo wall. And there was intense movement of mind to understand the meaning of bamboo. That was the entire force of my experience of that. What is this bamboo? What does it mean? So, you know, and it wasn't simple. I mean, I could recognize it, I could perceive it, but there was a very strong drive to understand the meaning of it. So I think it's a pretty strong impulse in us. I mean, if it happens upon waking up out of unconsciousness, if that's the first thing that happens. And I actually passed out a couple times and had the same experience both times. The second time it was a red carpet. It's like, wow, what is this red carpet? What does it mean? And, you know, it's like, it was so striking to me after, you know, I kind of came out of it. You know, what was that impulsion? What was that drive for meaning? And in my experience, in my recent practice, I've started to notice that drive to construct meaning a lot. That, you know, there's certain patterns that we seem to have in our bodies, certain configurations of tightness and tension that are really familiar to us. You know, a little bit of, contraction in the stomach or tightness around the heart. And I've noticed when I get into one of those configurations that I can see it, and then I almost immediately see the mind going, what does this mean? You know, if it's a feeling of, sometimes there's a particular one for me where there's a sense of something's wrong. You know, that's kind of the feeling in the body, something's wrong. And there's an immediate movement, what's wrong? Starting to scan the environment. What is wrong? And thinking the thoughts back. You know, what have I done wrong? You know, just basically out of that feeling is constructed this movement towards a meaning of it. And as I've started to see that movement towards meaning or constructing a meaning, I've seen that there's actually not necessarily, there doesn't necessarily need to be a meaning assigned to our experience. That's a construction of the mind. And it's not always necessary. Now, there may be times, and certainly I think part of the reason this was so deeply ingrained in us is that, you know, if you're, you know, standing in front of a tiger that's getting ready to leap at you, the meaning that that tiger is getting ready to chase you and try to eat you is pretty helpful to your survival, you know. So you're going to run, or maybe not run if that's not a good idea for a tiger. You know, but so there's probably a kind of a very tight link to survival in this movement towards creating meaning out of our experience. But I think we have taken it to an incredible degree in our daily lives. And we construct meaning out of just about everything. It's quite amazing when you start to really look at this, how much we take even just a simple pressure on the knee to have some meaning in our life. You know, what does it mean that I'm having this ache in my knee? Does it mean that I'm injuring my knee and that I'd better move? We definitely have this tendency to construct meaning. So this teaching is bringing us back to what is our bare experience. And partly what this does for us, if we are trying to stay with our bare experience, what we'll notice is where we're not staying with our bare experience. So we'll start to notice these movements out towards proliferation of thought, out towards constructing meaning, out towards a fantasy. And with that, we can say, oh, well, can I just come back to the bare experience? Another way, I'll just mention this also, because it's another piece that I found very interesting, that, you know, we can construct worlds out of our experience, or out of a particular thought, perhaps. We'll get into a thought pattern, a form, and we end up constructing a world that we believe in our minds. And I'll give you an example of this. I had a very long-term relationship with someone, and after he broke up with me, I had experienced a lot of anger and needed to really work through that anger. And after I had worked through all of that anger and feelings of betrayal and all of that, after many, many years of working with this, I started experiencing my thoughts about him in a very odd way. Before I had really gotten over him, when I experienced a thought about him, there was almost always an immediate reaction, you know, of, oh, you know, I'm so angry with him, and I'm so distraught right now, and I'll never be happy again. Now, there was a whole construction of that kind of thought that typically went along with memories of him. But what I noticed happening after I had worked through all the anger and had basically come to a place of complete forgiveness was that when a thought arose about him, there was still this pattern of creating a world in my mind around this thought. And I ended up, one day I was walking down the street and I ended up in this world where I was back in relationship with him and we were going to be doing something. And then I remembered, you know, after a few seconds, wow, you know, I'm not in that relationship anymore. And it was so strange. It was like my whole psyche had to shift for a second because the mind had gotten into that memory and completely believed it for those couple of seconds. But there was no reactivity to it, so there wasn't anything to yank me out of it, essentially. So it was quite startling to see just how solid and real those thought bubbles can become. You know, they can become whole worlds for us. And I think a lot of the suffering happens because we have those worlds and then we come out of them and realize, well, things aren't like that. And there's a suffering that results from that discrepancy. So again, this is something to explore for yourselves, this idea of coming and looking at the perceptions directly, only the seen, only the heard, only the sensed, only the cognized. Can we just contact our experience directly? So from here, the next part of the teaching the Buddha gives, he basically says, when for you, you have done this, when for you in the seen is only the seen and the heard is only the heard, then for you, this will happen. And so essentially the second part of the teaching, and I'll just read it briefly again. So when for you in the seen is merely a seen, etc., then you will not be with that. When you are not with that, you will not be in that. When you are not in that, then you will be neither here nor beyond nor in between the two. Just this is the end of suffering. So he's basically saying that this is a series of things that follows naturally. It's not something we have to do. It's more or less insights that happen when we are in contact with our experience directly in bare attention. So this part of the teaching is not something to do as much as it is an opening of the mind to certain aspects of reality. So I'll go through each of these pieces. The first one, he said, is you will not be with that. And my understanding of this is that the bare attention, as we come into contact with our experience with bare attention, we are closer essentially to the direct experience of knowing. In every experience, there is the thing that we know, the sight, the sound, the smell, the thought, and there is the knowing of it. There are those two things that come together. And the closer we get to the bare experience and not proliferating off into thoughts, the closer we are to the actual experience of knowing. And in that experience of knowing, there's some qualities of knowing that become clearer. And one of those is that the knowing is actually independent of the thing that is known. So there's kind of an independence of awareness that becomes clear. And this is a kind of a form of non-clinging, essentially. Typically, when we're experiencing a sight, a sound, a smell, you know, there's the knowing of it, but typically the knowing and the object are kind of intertwined. There's not really a way to disconnect them. But as we start to pay attention with mindfulness, we start to see that the knowing is a separate thing. It's actually a different thing. And that begins to allow it to untwine. And I'll give an example of this too, of what this feels like at least, this untwining experience, so that perhaps you can understand the difference between the intertwined and independent. So a couple of weeks ago, I had a vacation, or sort of a vacation. I went to live with my parents for a couple of weeks. And it was a nice visit. I had a really good time. And when I came back, I had a whole bunch of stuff to do. And, you know, just things that had accumulated while I was gone. And the first morning I was back, I went out for my usual walk. And I really noticed how restless I was. the mind was. It was just spinning out, oh, all these things I've got to do. And I could see that restlessness, but I was like, it was caught in it. There was that notion of what does this mean and how do I do something about it? Even though I could see it, there was this movement towards somehow fixing it or engaging in it. And after, it took a while, but after, of just kind of coming back and trying to say, okay, I see this restlessness, and spinning into that doing, you know, got to do something about this. What's the first thing I need to do? After about 10 minutes of that, it began to unentwine. And simply, I could see the restlessness. The restlessness did not go away immediately. There was still that spinning of mind. But there was no longer that movement to try to figure out what to do about it. It simply was restlessness unfolding in the body and mind. It's kind of like, you know, disengaging gears. You know, the gears, you know, when you have gears that are spinning and they're engaged, they keep each other going. And if you disengage the gears, you know, the gears still spin, but they're no longer, you know, being propelled anymore. And that was the sense of this, going from the being engaged and entwined in that restlessness to being just, oh, I just see it. It's like disengaging the gear from the experience. There's an analogy that is given in the suttas about this that's quite graphic. About this kind of experience of disengagement. And it is you'll just have to hear it. The Buddha said, it's like if you took a cow and cut the skin away from the carcass. If you just carved the entire skin away from the carcass. You could still put that skin back on the carcass and it would entirely match, fit the cow. But it is no longer connected. You can no longer say that it's connected to the cow. All of those ligaments are cut. And so you start to get this sense of there being kind of, it's slippery. You know, that's kind of the feeling that there's an exact connection between the experience and the knowing. They meet exactly, but they're no longer tied together. It's kind of slippery or lubricated between them. There's another translation of this, you will not be with that, that I found helpful also. That Tan Jeff says, he translated there is no you in terms of that. And that sometimes may be helpful, that basically there's no you in terms of the thing being experienced. The next piece is when you are not with that, or when there is no you in terms of that, you will not be in that. And Tan Jeff's translation of that is, when there is no you in terms of that, there is no you there. So this really speaks to complete non-identification with what we are experiencing. An understanding of simply things being a process. Seeing sees, hearing hears, thinking thinks. There's no doer involved. Now this is a true insight. This is not something we can construct. It's not something that we can believe. And again, I encourage you to come and see for yourself what happens as you engage more and more trying to connect directly with your experience as it is. And he goes on to say, basically, this leads us to the end of suffering. This understanding of know you there. And it follows to say that then when there's no you there, you are neither here nor yonder nor in between the two. Basically, no ground. Everything simply comes and goes because of a process. There's no here really to speak of. It's simply things changing. There's no there. It's simply things changing. So this brings us to a very radical definition of the end of suffering. So after Bahia heard this teaching, as I said, he became enlightened instantly. But the story doesn't end there, because very shortly after that, he left the Buddha. The Buddha went continuing on his alms round. And Bahia apparently walked between a mother cow and her newborn calf. And the mother cow charged Bahia and killed him. And I think this is an interesting part of the teaching. You know, and I think partly we need to understand the mindset of the culture at the time, that you know, there was a definite belief in rebirth, and also in this idea of that the rebirth, this idea of being reborn over and over and over and over and over again, was what we were trying to get out of. You know, that cycle of being reborn over and over again is being reborn into suffering over and over again. And complete liberation essentially takes us out of that cycle. So there are two things about this. This part of the teaching, I think. And, you know, I don't know completely what this means, but this is my understanding of it. I think part of it is about the urgency of practice. So if Bahia had not heard this teaching and not been fully enlightened, then when he died, he would have been continuing on this round, in this round of suffering. As it was when he died, he was completely liberated. And so he no longer continued in this round of suffering. So part of it is an urgency. You know, the sense of, we don't know when we're going to die. Don't delay. Practice now. And in fact, you know, I think Bahia had a sense of this, because he said to the Buddha, please, we don't know how long we're going to live. Teach me the Dharma now. So again, I'd really like to come back to the first talk that I gave about come and see, that these teachings don't do too much if we just listen to them. We really need to put them into practice. And we can put this into practice not only on our sitting on the cushion, but also in our daily lives, wherever we are walking or reaching or touching something, we can come into contact with our experience. We can try to notice when we're spinning out into thought and not in our direct experience. We miss so much of our lives by projecting into the future or remembering the past. So much of what we do in our thoughts is go back to the past or into the future. And so little of our time on this planet is actually spent here and now. And that's really all that we have, is here and now. So I think this teaching points us right back to here and now. Can we contact it? Can we really meet the moment? So come and see. See what happens for you as you try this practice. So are there any comments or questions? We could do a short guided meditation. I don't have as much time as I'd hoped for this, but I'll just give a little bit of instruction before we do this. So the guided meditation I'm going to do is on kind of an open awareness practice, sometimes called choiceless awareness. And what this does is basically opens us up to all of our experience, as opposed to focusing or rooting ourselves on an experience, on the sensations of breathing, for example. We allow ourselves to open up to whatever is happening in our experience without any anchor at all. So this can be challenging, and sometimes it can lead to confusion. But the basic idea is simply to, you know, we'll start with a minute or two maybe of stabilizing on the breath. And then I'll suggest that you let go of that and just start noticing what's happening in your experience. So the idea here, when I first tried to do this, I got completely overwhelmed because, like, wow, there's so much happening. You know, I kind of was confusing. But there's basically, you know, one kind of thing that the mind is drawn to in a particular moment. And see if you can see what that thing is. There's something that's kind of in the foreground of experience. It might be a pressure on the knee, a sound, something, a vibration in the body, a dryness in the mouth. There might just be something that kind of pushes its way into the foreground of experience. I look at this as a kind of following what the mind wants to pay attention to meditation. And in any moment, it probably will change. About every second, you may notice a new thing. And just try to be with that thing, and then you probably will notice some other thing coming in. And just try to be with that thing. And then let go. Let go. So part of this technique, really, is a way to help to just be with the bare experience as it comes. And then let go of it and go on to the next bare experience. So there's less time, actually, for the mind to actually, you know, latch onto it and do anything with it. Because we're just moving from thing to thing to thing. So I look at it as a kind of a sense of following where the mind is going. See if you can notice what the mind is already paying attention to. And then there'll be something else that comes in that it's paying attention to, and something else. So we can just start by settling into an upright posture. And begin in a way that you're familiar. Settling yourself perhaps on the breathing, perhaps on the sensations of hearing, if that's a more familiar or comfortable anchor for you. And now see if you can let go of the anchor and just notice what the thing is the mind wants to pay attention to. What is the most obvious experience? And then now, what is the most obvious experience? And now. See if you can relax your mind. And just notice what it does. You may notice many different sensations of heat, vibration, pressure, coolness, sounds. Maybe some thoughts. Notice each one and then let go and see what the next thing is. You might be experiencing confusion, and that could simply be the next thing you're experiencing. So notice confusion. And then see when something else appears, a pressure, heat. What is the mind already paying attention to? Thank you for your attention.